gentlemen, thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. And it is.
It's Centenalia.
It's the 25th of December. And like we tried to record yesterday, Yoel, didn't we? For Light of the Prophets. I had a huge electrical storm come over, and what was going on there? There was something going on there.
Oh, so our electrical grid in this area is really, really bad. It's kind of funny. We're not that far away from Jerusalem, but it feels like the third world here sometimes. So they've been trying to make sure that when storms come in, we don't lose all our power. Because storms, I mean, we had a massive, massive storm last week. It was so big. I mean, I'm living in the middle of the desert. You know, it's not the middle of the desert, but it's pretty desert-like. And we had this storm that was not less than storms that I grew up with when I was living in the north part of Israel. It was pouring with rain. We had flood areas. There were clouds. It was wind. I mean, it was so powerful. And we woke up in the morning. It was Friday morning. We woke up. And we look at my kids and go, we're not going anywhere. No one's going to school. No one's doing anything. We're all staying at home. Mm. It was a pretty serious storm. So we lost power several times. It's been going on since the winter began. So they came over and they're trying to, you know, prepare the grid now for storms and everything, so we don't lose our power. Because in this area, electricity is actually crucial, because if you don't have lighting, for example, and if someone tries to some terrorist group or something tries to get into the village, if we can't see them, it's a problem. Yeah, so they're working on that. And we also had a small village next to us, another small Jewish village. They actually had a whole herd of sheep stolen by some Arabs in this area.
Really?
So it caused the military and the big systems to realize this area does have its problems. Because this area has been relatively quiet for the past 4 or 5 years. They thought, oh, it's okay, there's an agreement with the village next to us and everything, and they basically realize it's not exactly like that. And now that the PA is considered to be a state of sorts, the Arabs think, oh, now we're a state, we can do whatever we want. These Israelis are occupying us officially, which is not accurate, but, you know, we all know that. So this is what the UN voted for, violence.
Yeah, that's it. And listen, well, by the way, Khani just came in and gave me a big slice of zucchini slice with salad. So if I sound like I'm eating, it's because I'm eating. All right, so I apologize for that. But listen,
what are you doing? Wait, this is a professional recording. People tune in to listen.
I know, but
it's... So us talk about the Bible, not you.
Well, it's because...
Put your foot aside.
No, I can't. It's because... you know, I mean, okay. So we don't do Christmas. We don't do the 25th of December. However, it seems, yeah, well, that a couple of traditions have sort of lingered on. You know, that we used to
stuffing
observe.
Your face, like stuffing your face. That's tradition.
Stuffing my face, and may I say, even I've had a couple of glasses of wine. Is that? Am I in trouble now?
I don't like the flavor. I cook with it, but I don't like drinking wine. Mm. And we traditionally say that when someone drinks alcohol, they shouldn't be teaching. So what's going to happen today is Jono is going to keep his mouth shut, and I'm going to be teaching everything.
You're going to be talking while I eat. Is that right? But listen, before I do that, what I wanted to ask you about is, hang on, wait.
Mm. I'm having a cup of tea, if it really interests you.
No,
you were drinking wine, and I'm having tea.
No, I'm not drinking wine while I'm on the air. I'm just saying that.
You're an alcoholic.
No, pitted olives. Pitted olives are better on air than olives that have not been pitted. Because what are you going to do when you've got the olive pit in your mouth? Because olives are so yummy, you've got to eat them. But now you've got... Anyway, it's out now. So what I'm saying is, you mentioned that there was an agreement between you and the village next door. What do you? Can you elaborate on that just for a second, please?
Oh, it's very simple. There's this unwritten, unspoken agreement that, okay, so there's a small village next to us, and we employ them. That the agreement is, you know, we can supply them with work, and they don't cause trouble. You know, the elders in the village know this very well. The problem is, you also have the teenagers who are influenced by Hamas, or, you know, hardcore Muslims who decide that they want to, you know, follow Hamas. So they're causing trouble. So lately this agreement's been breached a couple of times, and the army here is limiting their entrance now. They're saying, you know, okay, the trouble's coming from your village. We're not going to allow you to go in and work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And lo and behold, the past couple of days has been less and less workers in the village, less and less Arab workers.
Fair enough. And this is what you have to deal with. Let me now I have a question for you, Yoel. Now, you say the village next door. Currently, you are in the Judean desert, okay?
Yes.
You used to be in the old city. You used to be in Jerusalem, right?
True.
Today, the 25th of December, I mean, you've only just woken up. I'm in the evening of Christmas Day.
I've been up since 5:30 in the morning, so I've been up for quite a while.
Sure, but I mean, you know, it's still morning there. Now, listen, just bring it to the listeners. What usually happens on the 25th of December? What is the Christian intrusion? What is the Christian intrusion in Jerusalem on the 25th of December? As someone who used to live in the old city, what would you have to endure on a day such as today?
So in the old city, I mean, the big thing that we always saw was a lot of Orthodox Christians who come to Jerusalem, and they tend to go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, so that we would see some of them walking through the Jewish quarter. We didn't. Yes, we know. Yes, we know.
Hey,
but I need to be quiet.
No, you need to be quiet because Prince Halevi IV wants to say something. Actually, Prince Halevi IV is playing with a mutual friend, isn't he?
He's playing with a mutual friend, which shall not be named, for he has asked not to be named.
He's camera shy.
Yeah, microphone shy. they always made sure they keep it contained,
mm-hmm.
because the Muslims weren't really interested in having the Christians making a whole bunch of noise. The Jewish quarter, the only church that's really nearby the Jewish quarter is the Armenian church, and they celebrate based on a different calendar, so we never really had to deal with anything. We never got the big celebrations. I remember there was one night, I was walking around a couple of years ago, I was walking around the old city at night, and there was this massive group of Russian Israelis. I mean, we're talking about Russians that came to Israel, they're not even Jewish, that continue celebrating Christmas and whatever other feast that can be, we had them march through the Jewish quarter, not march, but walk through as a big group, and they're all wearing these red hats with the white pompon at the end and everything, Santa Claus hats and stuff. I think that was the worst we ever had. Besides that, it's pretty contained, so we never really had to deal with it. The only thing that we did have was at midnight we would have a church, the huge church bells go off. That was really most of it. But by 12 o'clock at night, most of the time I was asleep, so I didn't hear anything. There was a couple of times I was awake at that time, you could hear it. But
so
you never, they kept it very contained because they realized they kind of spilling it. The Jewish quarter is a Jewish quarter. There's no churches there. There's no, you know, no one's interested in Christmas there. So it never really spilled out to other areas.
So in different areas of Jerusalem, there's more action as far as the Christian Christmas experience is going on, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you go to South Jerusalem, for example, when you start going towards Bethlehem, you would see Christmas lights and stuff like that, but not, you know, it doesn't spill out that much. I mean, there are a lot of religious people inside the committee of the Jerusalem, the Jerusalem board of whatever. And they always make sure that they keep it contained there. If it's a Christian area, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. Let them knock themselves out. But if it's, for example, in the middle of Jerusalem, like on mm-hmm. Jaffa Street, which is like the center of town, you won't see Christmas lights or anything like that.
So certainly in the Judean desert, you've been spared entirely of the Christmas experience. Is that fair?
I would say something very simple. I was never really exposed to the Christmas experience until I actually moved to the old city, and that was very minimal. Mm. You know, if you go to Nazareth, for example, or Bethlehem, or places like that, you will be exposed to it. I have rarely, rarely been exposed to the whole Christmas experience, except for the Armenian neighbors I had that had Christmas lights and Christmas trees and stuff like that. But that was minimal as well. You know, it was like the window that was like, I don't know, like a snowflake or a star or something. It was never massive exposure. We never really had anything serious.
Well, I have to say, in the country town of Kara and in the rural situation that we are in, we haven't had to put up with anything. It's been beautiful. It was a lovely day, and I'm very happy to be sitting here at the end of it with you, my friend, because we are in 1 Samuel chapter 11. Shall we begin?
Yeah, we can begin that. But I will say something. The massive exposure Christmas I have this year is through Facebook, with all the friends I have on Facebook that you know, say, we don't celebrate Christmas.
Yes, right.
loads of friends of mine on Facebook, which, for example, come from a Messianic background or something like that. And I keep on getting these, like, for example, you know, videos explaining what Christmas really is, and pictures of, say, for example, Nimrod with a Christmas tree in one hand holding a reindeer and stuff like that, with a picture of Santa Claus on the other side. So that's the big exposure I'm having this year to this stuff.
Listen, that's enough schmoozing. We're going to get you schmooze too much. What are you?
I'm not
for half an
schmoozing.
Hour what are
I'm
you talking about?
I'm not schmoozing. We're talking. We have a very, very, you said yourself, we have a very, very short chapter. So I'm trying to fill in the time.
Okay.
I'm always ready. When it comes to the Book of Samuel, I'm always ready.
1 Samuel chapter 11. Then Nahash. What?
Snake.
Who is this guy?
Snake.
What? The snake. Serpent
His name
boy.
Is Snake. His really? Name is Snake. Nahash is Nahash. Snake.
This is his name. Why is that his name? Nahash, the Ammonite, right?
The Ammonite, yeah. So what's very interesting, he's not called Nahash, king of Ammon. He's called Nahash the Ammonite. Mm. So it's very degrading. He tried to degrade Israel. He tried to mistreat Israel. So when they write down him, when they write him down, they for example, oh, we forgot to mention he's king.
That's a good
point. Oops.
I didn't pick that up. That's a really good point. Then Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Yabesh Gilad. Yabesh Gilad, and all the men of Yabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve you. Why? But because they were big, because it was obvious they were going to be defeated. What?
So you have to remember, these are the settlements in Transjordan. Some of them were remote, and the people of Yabesh Gilad might have been by themselves for a while with not too many people around them. Mm-hmm. So an entire army, and I have to remember, the tribes were a federation of tribes. I mean, they actually recognize as being individual tribes that don't owe anyone anything unless there's an absolute threat towards everyone. So this is part of what this story projects. This story actually projects two things, okay? And you have to keep them in mind. Mm-hmm. The issue of the unity that comes through a king, okay? This story tries to focus on the positive of having a king, because the next chapter, Samuel bashes everyone over the head for wanting a king. But here, it teaches you the opposite. It's trying to tell you, okay, this is the positive side of having a king. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, okay, and here are the few lines you have to draw in your head from this one. The people of Yabesh Gilead were the ones who presumably gave wives the tribe of Benjamin to help the tribe of Benjamin reproduce. Now we're having a king from Benjamin saving the people of Yabesh Gilead.
Yes.
This is another thing that's going on here. So it's the issue of repaying a presumably good deed, because they really were kidnapped. People of Yabesh Gilead were slaughtered, and only the daughters of 400 women survived.
Mm.
So again, first of all, we have to ask the question, didn't they kill everyone in Yabesh Gilead? How was it repopulated? So the answer is, it's either that some of them survived, or that these are descendants. These might be descendants of the daughters of Yabesh Gilead, and they went back as the laws of Slavchad say. If there's only daughters, they inherit, and their children will inherit. So these might be families from the daughters of Yabesh Gilead who were taken away, that went back to inherit their own land.
That's an excellent. So honestly, Yoel, I didn't think of that, and that's a really good point. And of course, we see the precedent for that. Is it in Devarim? Is it in Deuteronomy? There were the daughters of.
No, it's in the end of Numbers, if I remember correctly.
I think you're
it's
right.
It's in the end of Bamidbar.
The end of Numbers, and it talks about, you know, because the question is asked, hey, listen, our father died, he had no sons, where are his daughters? What happens with the inheritance? And of course, Moses goes to Jehovah and says, hey, this is a good question. What do you reckon? And he says the inheritance goes to the daughters. The last chapter.
Yeah, it's the last chapter of Bamidbar, chapter 36, and they go to This is where you have the actual entire explanation. So you have the description here. The tribes go to Moses and say, listen, if they marry the tribe of Menashe, no? Yeah, the family of the family of Gilad, son of Machir, son of Menashe, from the families of Joseph, they go to Moses and say to him, you know, if the daughters of Tzlofchad marry someone else, the inheritance goes to them. So we lose land.
Hmm.
And you have to remember, having land means you have you have something to live off of. If you don't have land, unless you're a Levite, you know. That's our mutual friend making noise together with my son. he's being a very, very good man, and he's watching over Yonatan, making sure he doesn't fall over the chairs. Yonatan is going into this whole thing. My Halevi the fourth, his name is Yonatan. And which is the same name that you have. Jono is Jonathan.
That's right.
And he's actually named after Jonathan. He's actually named after my grandfather, whose name was Jonathan, and he was a soldier. He was a soldier in the British Air Force, and he's the only relative of mine that actually sat in a camp during the Second World War. But he sat in a Japanese camp.
Wow, is that right? Oh, I remember you told me about that. And so Yohanatan is named after him.
So he's named after my grandfather, who was an amazing man. He was a gardener, and he had a beautiful garden behind his house. I mean, I wish.
I wish. Little Yohanatan's taking the spill.
I think you don't need to be on the chairs anymore. I think we're done with the chairs.
Poor little Yohanatan. Oh, poor little Prince Halevi the Fourth.
No more chair for you. But what he's been doing lately is been sitting every time I sit down to work and he's at home, or every time I sit down on a chair, he pulls up a chair and sits next to me, and he's really getting good at it.
Yeah, because he's looking at Dad, and he's going, hey, Dad's on Truth to You. I want to be on Truth to You. Obviously, I need a chair.
Yeah, and he's pulling up chairs, and he's sitting, and he's been getting really, really good at it. It's pretty amazing to see how your children grow. So going back to someone else's children, so it seems that these were families that basically went back to inherit their birthright. So this is probably how Yavesh Gilead was repopulated.
It's a very good point that you make. And it goes on to say, and Nahash the Ammonite answered them and said, on this condition I will make a covenant with you that I may put out all your right eyes and bring reproach on Israel.
So pulling out eyes or blinding people is actually a very disgraceful thing to do in the world. They did it to Samson. They did it to Zedekiah. Basically, maiming someone, removing limbs and stuff like that was a symbol of disgrace. It also creates a handicap, because what it can also do is, okay, we're going to pull out all your right eyes. Most people at the time, most people in the world are right-handed, which means their right eye is a stronger eye, which would limit them. For example, you have to remember, these are probably descendants of Benjamites, so they might have been left-handed. But maybe many because they're really descendants of a lot of people
particularly in archery, Yoel.
Yeah, exactly. So it limits their ability. Remember, they spoke about the tribe of Benjamin, the book of Judges. The tribe of Benjamin were snipers, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So you pull out their eye, you're limiting their ability to fight.
It's all over. So it's all over. It sets them back, as far as security is concerned, sets them back greatly. And then the elders of Yabesh said to him, hold off for 7 days that we may send messengers to all the territories of Israel, and then if there's no one to save us, we will come out to you and you can pluck out all our eyes. But obviously what the snake was hoping to do was to take it peacefully rather than you know, go in and a ground assault, so to speak. He has encamped around it, and they see the numbers and they think, well, we're not going to win if we go to fight. So if we can resolve this peacefully, he can have our eyes. Or if someone's going to come and save us, well, even better.
So what we're basically looking at here is that they're relying on the tribal unity, the tribal understanding that we're really one nation. I mean, it's very interesting because this is not unusual for the ancient world. The Greeks were like this as well. I mentioned this quite a while back, very, very long time ago. But for example, in Greece, the cities they understood that they're together. And this is why, for example, when the Persians attacked Greece, the reason the Athenians went and helped the Spartans was because they realized that they actually share a background, they share a cultural background, they share ancestral background. And mm-hmm. this is the same idea here. I mean, for example, here in Israel today, put aside all the crazy leftists and, you know, and pacifists and the rest of those types that we mm-hmm. have in Israel. In general, when, for example, there is an attack somewhere here in Israel, there's a unity that suddenly pops up. Suddenly everyone's united. Suddenly there's a lot of support towards the army and everything. Sure. And that's kind of the mentality. I mean, patriotism here in Israel is, you know, we're not really patriots here in Israel. Many people are not. It's because they're claiming for what's called post-Zionism. Mm-hmm. You know, but I side saying a lot of people being a patriot is, you know, saying I'm a patriot is, you know, a patriot is not a rude word. It's not a dirty word. End of story.
Mm.
And what's interesting is really, you know, you have all these, you know, anti-Zionist groups and, you know, leftist groups here in Israel. And at the end of things, when you, for example, Independence Day, most people in Israel celebrate Independence Day. Even ultra-Orthodox Jews, many of them celebrate Independence Day.
Mm.
Seriously. It's a day they use to go out and have a barbecue or something.
No, you got to stop talking. I love the sound. I love the sound of
it. It's the voice of another Levite sitting in the land of Israel, laughing, and hopefully one day we'll all laugh in that way, like children with pure joy, when God reveals Himself and says, "Okay, that's it. I'm getting involved." He's always involved, but you know, I remember as a teenager, a friend of mine bought this Passover Haggadah.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a picture there of it was a Haggadah printed in the 70s, and they were talking. There was a Haggadah that came out about, for example, the Russian Jews who were behind the Iron Curtain and were not able to leave Russia. And there was a picture there of a Russian, you know, the Kremlin, with soldiers around it, and a hand mm-hmm. coming out from heaven, flicking the rooftops of the Kremlin building. So it was a pretty amazing Haggadah. It's just like, you know, God being directly in voice, your hand coming out of heaven, slapping everyone.
Yeah. And may it be today, may it be soon. I love the sound of that. Little Yohannatan, Prince Halevi IV, in hysterics with our mutual friend there. All right, we better keep going. So the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and told the news in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept, Yoel. And now there was Saul coming behind the herd from the field, and Saul said, "What troubles the people? Why are they weeping?" And they told him the words.
Notice something about Saul. He's coming back from behind the oxen in the field.
He's still working in the field.
He's still a normal person.
He's been anointed as commander in the midst of the people, but he's still out there in the field working the herd.
Yeah, exactly. He's not a divine king. He's not a half god. He's not a demigod or something.
Mm.
He's an average person with an average life. And it really became this royal, you know, divine type of kings and everything in Israel and Judea and Judah. It really developed later on, hundreds of years later, when the king started becoming very, very arrogant. And I would say it's reasonable to say that the kings were influenced by the pagan thought of what a king is, to a point where they believed they had absolute power, and they probably believed that they were divine. Because it says, for example, there's a midrash that says about King Joash that he at one point actually believed that he was divine.
Mm-hmm.
Because he spent, as a child, as a baby, they say that he was in the temple area because he was living in the house of Jehoiada the high priest. Which meant he lived in the temple precinct. So people believed that he was divine, that he came out of the temple. Yonatan.
Shh. No, don't quiet him down. The people are loving it. Come on, he's beautiful.
I don't know. I want to hear responses by people. I want to hear from the people. I don't want you saying it.
Come on, everybody write in. Okay, I want everyone to write in and comment and say how extremely cute Yohanan, Prince Halevi IV, and I mean, honestly, we all tune in just to hear him. Don't stop him from laughing. Come on. I mean, you know, you're good too, but
all right. I'm good too. He does the show.
And they told him the words of the men of Yabesh, and then Yoel, come on. I mean, seriously, this is serious stuff. The Spirit of God came upon Shaul when he heard the news, and his anger was greatly aroused. The Spirit of God came upon him, and he became angry.
So the Spirit of God, by the way, is a motif in the whole story of Saul. He has the good spirit and the bad spirit afterwards hits him.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of the idea that there is a divine realm regarding the king, but it's exterior to him. Mm-hmm. And the king only works through the influence of God. And if he goes with God and he follows the word of God and he listens to what God has to say, God will be directly involved in his abilities. Mm-hmm. He will be able to stand up and fight a war. Even, for example, he's a wimp. If, for example, he's a person who has no abilities. For example, there's a verse in Isaiah that says, "No, and the ve'omar chalash giborani, the weak person will say, I am a mighty man, I am a hero." You know, it shows the issue of the direct intervention of God with the abilities of man. You know, Samson, for example, Samson, for example, in the Midrash is described as a midget that was very weak.
For all we know, he could have been a weakling. For all we know, he could have been a scrawny little chap.
Exactly. So this verse basically says, okay, Saul is going to protect the people of God. He is the representative of God. He is the soldier of God on earth. Mm. And therefore, when he goes and follows the word of God and does it, God brings down a spirit on him that enables him to do it. And this is why he becomes so intense and he's angry and everything. And he is about to do something very, very interesting as well, which connects us again to the story of the people of Yavesh Gilad.
Yes, it does. Once again, we're back in the book of Judges, because what he does, Yoel, and it's no small thing that he does here. He took a yoke of oxen. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that means two. He took a couple of oxen.
He took two. And now, if you've ever worked with animals, you know that most animals, the best way to take them apart is basically into six pieces.
Sure. Okay, so I have. And because I do the, every now and then I take apart a goat. But it's not a...
Don't eat me.
It's more a sort of, I go out there in the early hours of the morning and there they are, and I say to them, and they look at me and they go, we have a conversation first thing in the morning. But, every now and then, I butcher one. And it's not an easy thing, and that's a goat. But goodness me, Yoel, I would never attempt to take an oxen. That's way beyond my abilities. And yet here is Shaul, and he does a couple. He does a yoke of oxen. He cuts them into pieces and he sends them.
He needs 12 pieces, so six from each one.
There it is. Perfect. Yeah, well done. And the territory of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, whoever does not go out with Shaul and Samuel to Saul and Samuel to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen. And
that's the same thing. Yeah, and it says the same thing with this Levite. He took his concubine, he cut up into 12 pieces and sent her pieces around the land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing here. So this is the thought I had, that this was the atonement for the story of the concubine on Givah. This might be the atonement.
Perhaps.
That similar actions with a similar storyline, but this time God is involved directly, and they're saving the people who helped save the tribe of Benjamin. So it's through the tribe of Benjamin who sinned. Now the representative of the tribe of Benjamin is standing up and protecting the people of Israel, the exact opposite of what happened in Giv'ah. And so this might be an atonement for the whole story.
That's really interesting. Honestly, Yoel, I haven't thought about it in that light so specifically. I'm going to have to spend some time on that, and that's really valid what you say. And it says, and really what he's saying is, I'm going to trash your tractor if you guys don't come out and help me, right? And so
I'm going to scratch your Volvo and I'm going to trash your tractor.
Trash your tractor. It says, the fear of the Lord fell on the people and they came out with one consent. And that's another thing too that we see in that passage in Judges, isn't it? They come out with one consent.
Yeah, it says, it uses the same term, ki ish echad.
It uses
the exact same term, ki ish echad. Everyone's like, okay, we're doing this. And they get up and they go to war.
And they go to war. And then, if I remember correctly, and people can go back to the final chapters of Judges, Yoel and I did in Light of the Prophets, I do believe we did make a lot of parallels between that passage and the passage we're reading now.
I actually do not remember, but probably you're right.
I think we did. And so verse 8, it says, when the number, when they numbered them in Bezek, the children of Israel were, get this, 300,000, Yoel, and the men of Judah, 30,000. 10% of them were from Judah. And they said...
So, by the way, this is a classic thing that happens from this point on. Actually, no, it happens in the Book of Judges as well. Tribe of Judah suddenly becomes, like, special. This is probably related to something of later editing, or that the book of Samuel was actually written amongst the inside the tribe of Judah, because from a certain point onwards, we see that Israel and then Judah by itself, Israel and then Judah by itself. And you have to remember that at the time, the tribe of Joseph was really the most important. The tribes of Joseph, you know, Menashe and Ephraim, specifically Ephraim, were the most important tribe. And after them, Judah, and the Levites and the priestly families were like in a completely different world. But we start seeing the linkage to Judah becoming the most important tribe. Because the first, I mean, if you go, for example, there's a psalm in the book of Psalms. It's Psalm 78. Towards the end, it says, and he forsook the tribe, the tent of Joseph, and the tribe of Ephraim he did not choose. This is Psalm 78, verse 67, and in 68 it says, and he chose the tribe of Judah and Mount Zion, which he loved. So, you know, it's an issue. He was starting to see the hinting of, okay, Joseph and Benjamin, fine, yeah, but Judah really is the one that gets chosen to lead the people at one point. Every time I read this one, I think about, you know, so the whole story with the Samaritans and Mount Gerizim and all that has to do with the whole thing of, you know, trying to push that Joseph is the chosen person. And actually, if you go to Samaritans and you ask them, say, oh yeah, this David guy rebelled against the true kingship. You know, so it's part of the discussion. I've actually heard this before because I used to live not too far away from where they live, and I heard this from one of them. They go like, oh yeah, you Judean, you the Jew, tribe of Judah, rebelled against the true place of the tabernacle and everything. And truthfully, when you look at it, there were loads and loads of little temples all over the place. You know, so there was one in Shechem as well, which is just next to Mount Gerizim. So, you know,
sure.
Not unusual. It's an interesting discussion, the whole thing of temples in Israel and stuff like that. But no time for it now.
Verse 9, and it says, and they said to the messengers who came, thus you shall say to the men of Yavesh Gilad, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have help. Oh, my goodness, what a relief that is. And then the messengers came and reported it to the men of Yavesh, and they were glad. No kidding. Therefore...
Now, by the way, again, we have the word malachim here, which is from the word malach.
Yeah.
Now, your translation says messengers, which is true. But the thing is that, for example, based on the Greek translations, it uses the angelos, the angel.
It'd be angels.
So again, you have to remember, and I was asked about this a couple of days ago, last week or something, from one of the listeners. And they asked about, messengers, angels, and stuff like that. So you have to remember, and malach in Hebrew is a messenger. The angels, what we usually call the angelic beings, are called malachim as well because they are the messengers of God. But when you use the word malach, you don't necessarily mean an angel. You also mean can be also a human being that functions as a messenger, and in certain cases, the messenger of God.
I'm glad you brought it up, and I'm just going to say it again. I've said it before. I do believe, for myself, I prefer to use the word messengers all the time, and then determine whether or not you think that it's someone who is not a man, someone who is not human, someone who is from the kingdom of God where he resides. You can make that decision, but I think in the English, the word angel is applied perhaps a little too frequently, and I do prefer to use the word messengers. So thank you for bringing that up, and clearly... we're talking about men who are messengers here. They came to Gavesh and they were glad to hear the news. And therefore, the men of Gavesh said, they said tomorrow. They said to the snake, hey, listen, hey, we'll come out to you tomorrow and you can pluck our eyes out if you like. because they knew
it. No, actually, no, they don't say that. They say, and the people, it says, and the people in the Yavesh said to the messengers of Nachash, tomorrow we will come out to you and you will do to us whatever pleases you.
Mm-hmm.
They're not saying, okay, tomorrow we're going to surrender. They're saying, tomorrow you try to do whatever you want to do. It's a double meaning. So tomorrow we're going to come out. Tomorrow we're going to be standing in front of you. They're not saying to pluck our eyes out, but they're not really telling them what's going to happen.
What's in store for them?
What they're doing, it's a strategy. What they're doing is they're telling them tomorrow we will come to you. Machal, which is usually tomorrow, which means tomorrow at sunrise or sometime during the day. Okay, it's a terminology is very, very clear. It's not tomorrow, just, you know, tomorrow. It's not the same thing. It's actually tomorrow during the day. They're telling them, you know, we're going to, they're kind of hinting to them, we're going to be surrendering and stuff like that. But they're not actually saying that. What they're saying is tomorrow during the day, we'll come out and you can do whatever you want to do.
That's right.
And they're not telling them that there's an army coming. They're not telling them that it's a strategy what's going on here.
Yeah,
and we can actually draw lines of parallel with what Saul does here and what Gideon did.
Oh, true. That's
they do very similar actions.
Very good point. And so they're buying time. And so it was in verse 11 that the next day that Saul put the people in three companies. There it is. And they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch and killed Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it happened that those who survived were scattered so that no two men were left together.
So it says Bashmoret HaBoker. So Bashmoret HaBoker is the morning watch, but it's not. It's the watch just before sunrise. So that's the point where essentially we're technically supposed to be in the deepest point of sleep at night, by the way. Because if you look at the cycles we go through, if you ever studied the issue of sleep cycles, you sleep the deepest towards the night, towards the end of the night.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the body's really gone into the whole deep sleep.
Mm.
And that's where most dreams happen, by the way. Mm-hmm. If you remember that, we should notice that if you're dreaming in the beginning of the night or the middle of the night, you usually don't remember that dream. You remember that you dreamt, you don't remember the dream.
That is but so when annoying. You reach, Yoel, there's nothing more annoying. Do you know how many times I have had dreams where I know absolutely everything and everything makes sense? And then I wake up, can't remember it.
So the thing is that when you dream, when you're sleeping, when you're asleep at the end of the night, and that's the deepest point of sleep, that's when your dreams are the most vivid, and usually you remember them.
Well, no, the point is I knew everything.
You knew everything.
I did. I knew everything. Everything made sense, and I knew everything. And I've had multiple dreams like this, and I wake up, gone.
Well, Sigmund Freud would have said that you suffer from a syndrome called, and it's all related to the fact that you love your mother.
And then the people said,
that you suffer from Oedipus syndrome.
And then people
said, sorry about this.
People said to Samuel, now get this, Yoel, people said to Samuel, who is he who said, okay, so you pointed out last week in verse 27 of chapter 10, where it says, but some of the rebels said, and you pointed out, well, it's not just this, the rebels, these are men of Belial, these are men without yoke, these are the lawless men, how can this man save us? And so they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his, Saul held his peace. And now that Saul kicks butt here, right, and the people are saying,
use cleaner terminology.
Well, I can't say butt, but
it's the thought police sometimes. No,
anyway, okay. So he's been victorious, and the people came to Samuel, and he said, "Who are these guys who said shall Saul reign over us? Bring those men that we may put them to death." But Saul said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today Yehovah has accomplished salvation in Israel."
So, by the way, this is the exact opposite of what happens with him later on, when he starts becoming more and more, I would say, kind of arrogant. That at one point, when they went to battle the Philistines later on in the book, he's willing to kill his own son.
Oh, that's true.
His son tells everyone no one eats until I say so. Yeah. And his son doesn't hear the oath, and he's willing to eat it from the honey.
Yep.
And he says, I'm going to put him to death. You know, he broke my word, and it's the exact opposite. Now the people are trying to protect someone from dying. You see a shift in his character.
Mm.
He becomes paranoid. He becomes mentally ill. But you see that when he follows God, he does the word of God, and the Spirit of God is upon him,
mm-hmm.
he acts reasonably.
But no, listen, that's an excellent point. I didn't connect that, but you're absolutely right. And we will get to that, obviously. The situation where they're in battle, he declares no one will eat until we're victorious and so on and so forth. Jonathan, Yehonatan, again, did not hear the commandment of his father. He takes a stick, he takes some honey, and he eats of it. And Saul was willing to put him to death. And yet the people saved him in that situation. We're gonna come to that, but you're absolutely right. It's a complete reverse of the situation. And verse 14, Samuel said to the people, come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. What does that mean, to renew the kingdom? What's that about?
Well, actually, if you start this, then we have to flow into chapter 12. I don't know if it's a good idea, but renew the kingdom, and basically, okay, now let's have last time we gathered, we crowned him, but people went like, shrug, shrug, we don't care. Now he's saying, okay, now you all realize that he's actually useful as a king, and he's worth it, because this story, part of the reason the story happened,
mm-hmm.
you have to remember, there's no coincidences. How does Nehemiah call it? God incidences?
God incidences, yeah. God incidences.
God incidents. There's another part of this, you know. He is a real king. He has the ability to do what you want a king to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what's going on. So now Samuel, and this is why the story is immediately afterwards, he says to them, okay, let's renew this. Now let's have this done properly without people going like, boo, we don't want him as a king. Let's do this the right way. Let's correct this.
Right. Okay. Very good point. Well, listen, let me just read the last verse, because this is going to end chapter 11 for us, and we're going to obviously go into greater detail in chapter 12 next week. But it says, so all the people went to Gilgal, and they made Shaul king before Yehovah in Gilgal, and there they made sacrifices of peace offerings before Yehovah, and there Shaul, Saul, and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. And that ends chapter 11.
By the way, rejoicing greatly, this style of language is also used in the crowning of King Solomon, the crowning of King Joash or Joash, the same language. This is a big thing. Mm. You know, we have a king, and we have a good king. We have someone reasonable.
And, so rejoice greatly when we're talking about all 12 tribes coming together as one consent and rejoicing in a major, major way, right?
Exactly. This is a big, big, big thing, because it changes the dynamics of what was going on up to that point in Israel and amongst the tribes. You see, suddenly there's unity. There's a person who puts his foot down. He takes care of everyone. He cares for everyone. And
he kicks butt.
That one again. So yeah, he basically is what they expect him. You know, this is what they wanted as a king.
He's the man.
But Samuel still emphasizes in the next chapter that, okay, he might be the man, but he's not it. What's it is God, and he puts criticism there as well. And he's saying, okay, let them have their happiness now, but I have to keep them in check all the time. And this is like something that we have to learn for ourselves in everyday life. I mean, for example, our house, a family, the father of the house is the master of the house, is the king of the house, and it's a microcosmos of a kingship. And you know, you as a family, you know, anyone as a family, we are responsible for the actions of our children. We are responsible for the actions of our family. Mm-hmm. And, you can learn from all these things in microcosmos. You, if you want to be blessed, if you want to continue, if you want to have a normal house, you always have to keep yourself in check. There's a wonderful book that came out 300 years ago called Mesilat Yesharim, the path of the righteous, or the path of the straightforward, or the, I'm not sure exactly how to translate it. It's actually a phrase from the book of Proverbs, and he does an introduction. You can actually find this book online for free, Mesilat Yesharim, just write it as it sounds, And you should be able to find this book online in English. And his introduction to the book is a very interesting thing. He says, you know, when you're doing business, when you're counting pearls, when you're counting diamonds, when you're counting your money, you always make sure everything is exact. But how many of us actually sit there and count our actions? How many of us actually sit there and think about what we've done throughout the day? How many of us actually notice what we've done, how we behaved with the neighbor, how we did with that person, how did we conduct ourselves with that? Did we really truthfully follow the Torah there? And he actually gives wonderful advice, and he says, take a couple days during the week, or take a day once a week or something, and just before you go to sleep, sit there and ponder about your actions. Think of what you've done. Think of how you conducted yourself throughout life. And what you're really doing, you're becoming a prophet to yourself. I'm not talking about, you know, prophecies really, but we're talking about what the major point of the prophets was, to
hold accountable to the Torah.
Exactly. And we're all accountable to ourselves. You know, going back now to you know, what goes on with Saul. Saul is the king of Israel, and being the chosen king of Israel is a pretty massive responsibility. So you're accountable to everything you do. This is what Samuel does. We just had a victory. And immediately after the victory, they do a celebration. And now he says, okay, now we've had our fun. Down back to business. And he starts bashing everyone over the head. He says, no, remember what you did. Remember your behavior. Remember that you rebelled. He's not telling them you're wicked, you're evil, repent, and smacks them and say, you know, if you don't, you'll burn in hell. And he doesn't do that.
He makes them own it, right?
Exactly. The conception of time in the ancient world was kind of like looking backwards. We don't move forward in time. There was a different way of looking at it. We're always really not facing the future. We're facing the past. Because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We only know what happens in the past. It's like as if you're singing your time travel machine, and you're going forward in time, but you only see the past happening. You don't really see the future happening. He's basically saying, okay, now that we've seen that this works, and we've seen the futuristic possibilities of this, let's remember what the past teaches us. And we always have to think of what we've done in the past, how we've conducted ourselves, and learn how to develop out of that, how to grow out of that, how to make ourselves better by learning from what was done in the past. Because we don't know what the future holds. But we do have a promise in the Deuteronomy that says, if we truthfully follow the Torah, the future will be good for us.
Brilliant.
And this is the lesson of the kingship.
And this is what's coming too in chapter 12. And thank you for leaving us with that, Yoel Ben Shlomo of Hebrew in Israel. And just a reminder to the listeners, Hebrew in Israel, you can find it on Facebook. Type it in, Hebrew in Israel. Go to the page, like it, and engage with the information. My friend, thank you for coming back onto Truth to You.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have you, my friend. Who'd have thought we'd been doing a program on Christmas Day?
Yeah, so I was going like, wow, we're going to do a recording on what's called Christmas Day. And I was going like, I don't know if it's weird because I don't live in this reality. I mean, living in Israel, you know, you don't really think about it. But
Not with you. It's kind of weird. Anyway, no, listen, I mean, obviously, I do like to think that the majority of our listeners do not engage and indulge in such things. But in any case, it is the 25th of December, and I do hope that the listeners, regardless of the way they observe it, have a great day. And until next week, when we are in 1 Samuel chapter 12, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word, the truth. You won't find that on the 25th of December. The truth of our Father's word, shalom.
Shalom, kol tov.